Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and The Powerful Patient focuses on issues of interest to people who are managing complex medical conditions or anything where you're dealing with more than one medical specialty and also various kinds of disabilities. We try to help you learn how to manage your health and manage your healthcare team as well. Today we're going to talk about stroke, how to recognize that someone around you is having a stroke, what to do about that, and the road to recovery after a stroke. We'll meet Paul Seibert, who's written a book about his own experience in recovering from stroke. We'll be announcing the first winners of the Food Matters contest and also telling you how you also can win a free viewing of the Food Matters video on the internet. So please stay with us, and we will be right back after this message to learn more about stroke. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find there the handout that goes with this show with important information to supplement the program, websites that we've talked about, and additional information on this topic. So please go to powerfulpatient.org, and we hope too that you'll make a donation there to support our work. That's powerfulpatient.org. So what is a stroke anyway? A stroke is an event, a brain attack, if you will, that occurs when a blood vessel in your brain is either clogged or ruptured. This interrupts the flow of blood and oxygen to your brain, and brain cells can start to die. Stroke can lead to death or to long-term disability, such as some paralysis, or loss of memory or speech or other important abilities in your body. It's very important if you have a stroke to recognize that that's what's going on and to get yourself to an emergency room as quickly as possible. The most successful recovery from stroke happens when treatment is obtained within the first 3 hours. So it's the first step, of course, is to recognize that a stroke is in fact what's happening to you and to get yourself some help. So how do we do that? There's actually a scale, a handy little way of telling whether you're having a stroke. The first one is to smile and to check the smile. So if you or a friend near you is having something going on and you're wondering whether it's a stroke, the first thing is to ask them to smile and to look and see if the smile is straight or if one side of the mouth is going up and the other side is going down or not moving. If it's symmetrical, that's a good thing. If it's not symmetrical, that's not a good thing. The second thing is to ask them to say a simple sentence, like, "It's a sunny day outside," and to see if they can say that sentence without slurring their speech. And the third one is to ask them to raise both hands. If they can raise both hands as if they were asking a question and the two hands go up symmetrically, they both go up to the same height, that's a good sign. If one arm goes up higher than the other one, that's not a good sign. So these are just a couple of the simple things that you can ask your friend to do to see if they might be having a stroke. They're not the only ones. Some of the other things that can occur is whether there might be a sudden unexplained headache or a change in the pattern of headaches that they've been experiencing for the last several days or so. There might be a sudden weakness or numbness in the face or arm or leg or maybe on one side of the body. Maybe there's some difficulty in understanding speech that's different, something sudden that occurs that's different. Or there might be some dimness or loss of vision. Again, something that happens suddenly. And particularly if it happens only in one of the two eyes, that when something happens on one side of the body and not the other side of the body, that is one of the suspicious things that you should be concerned about. If there's some unexplained dizziness or unsteadiness, or if the person falls down for no reason, or if they may have difficulty in swallowing something, or if they lose consciousness, these are the kinds of events that we should be concerned about. So if you're concerned, don't wait. Don't drive, especially if this is happening to you, don't drive, but do call 911 and tell them what the symptoms are, and they will swing into action and come and help you out. So it's important to get to the hospital as quickly as possible, and don't forget that 3-hour limit. So you shouldn't just wait and see if the symptoms may clear up. It's better to be safe than sorry, and to take action earlier rather than later. There's a company that has put together a cute little song to help us remember these things. It's put together by an organization called Mountain Wings, and it's being made freely available. So I'm going to include it with the show here, and we've also got the pointer to Mountain Wings in the handout set. So here we are. This is the stroke song.
Singing this song can save a life. Singing this song can save your wife. It can save a Pasadena resident. It can even save the president. He's a mean fellow. He'll take you under, take your legs, your arms, and leave you a mumbler. Twisting and turning, maiming and killing. He may be working, chill.
Say this line. If they're talking smooth, then things may be fine. Say repeat after me. Just follow my guide. It's a sunny day outside. The smile is straight and the speech is not slurred. They pass the first two, now on to the third. Tell them raise both hands like in a stick-up. If the fingers are even, they may be in luck. If one hand is higher, it means something's wrong. It means it's time for you to get on the phone. If they don't pass any one of the three, call 911 expeditiously.
Yeah.
Now, in case you're wondering why that baby is giggling at the end, the writers of the song tell us that one of the primary causes of stroke is stress. Stress is at the top of the list. So the giggle from their baby at the end is to remind us that laughter and joy counteract stress, and that's probably the most important lesson of all, is to remember to laugh. And if you haven't already listened to our program called Laughter Matters, I would recommend that you do that, because it's a delightful program with Sandy Boris Berkowitz on the importance of laughter and keeping laughter in our lives. I'd like to introduce to you Paul Seibert. Paul had a stroke 3 years ago and has written a book about his experience recovering from stroke.
So, Paul, it's very nice to have you with me today, and I understand you have a new book called I Know How Hard You Work. So can you tell us what that title is about and tell us what motivated writing this book?
Well, I think the thing that made me want to write the book was cathartic for me as I started my recovery. It was very cleansing and renewing for me to do it, and it made me feel good. But as time went on, I realized that there were other people out there that were recovering from strokes that they had, and I knew how hard they worked because I knew how hard I worked. And as I wrote the words in a Word document, I realized that I was encouraging them, the readers, but I was also helping me. So as I helped them, I helped me.
So you had a stroke yourself?
Yes.
And when was that?
I'm sorry?
When was your stroke?
It was 3 years ago, next month.
Great.
It was an ischemic stroke, a clot stroke.
So you had a clot. And when did this happen? It happened at home?
Yes, I was sitting at home that day, and I didn't even know the exact moment that it happened. It's just that when I got up to walk into the other room, I couldn't walk right. And I had to kind of like walk, with my right leg. It was very, very clumsy, and I realized that something was terribly wrong, so I called 911.
Uh-huh.
Got right into the hospital.
Well, that was good, because from what I understand, the speed with which they begin working on you is a major factor in your recovery.
Very much so. I got in just under the three-hour limit of a point in time that I could receive the TPA clot buster drug that actually dissolves the clot and enables the person to recover faster than he normally would have because the clot is gone, and it's a matter of the brain developing new neural pathways around the dead cells.
Right. So if someone is having a stroke, the first order of business is to get yourself to the hospital ASAP.
Absolutely.
And how do you tell if you're having a stroke?
You know, I'm not really totally sure. I just couldn't move the left side of my body. I had a second stroke in the hospital, and it affected my speaking. So if your voice is sounding slurry or lazy, these may be indicators. So, yeah, I've heard about the smile. I wasn't so much looking at my smile because I was trying to get to the bathroom, and quite frankly, to watch a guy that has just had a stroke hop into the bathroom on one leg is pretty it's pretty strange looking. But then I laid down on the bed and I said, call 911, do it right now. So by the time I got there, by the time the ambulance took me in, they were trying to get my blood pressure down, and it was at that point pretty high. And when it got down to, I believe, 105, the lower number, they could administer the drug. So, and they did that intravenously, and I was very more happy later than initially because of what it meant to me.
Right, absolutely. So after you had the stroke, and then you said you had a second stroke in the hospital, that when did you begin working on your recovery?
Well, I was in the hospital for a week. They were stabilizing my meds and waiting for a bed to open on the rehab unit. And I was in the regular hospital for a week, and then they transferred me to the rehab hospital, a part of the same system.
Mm-hmm.
It was a UHS system. And I began the rehab work that second week. And I was there in that rehab unit for 3 weeks. And that was probably longer than some. Some may stay only a couple of weeks, but I was more weakened with my on the left side than I realized. And so when they transferred me over there, they began to work me pretty hard. It was a very different hospital environment there than it was in the regular hospital. It was kind of like going from Club Med to the boot camp, if you know what I'm saying.
That's a good way to put it.
Let's take a little break here, and we'll be back to talk some more with Paul about his recovery from stroke. We'll also learn more about his own music and also about the Food Matters contest coming up toward the end of the show. So stay with us, and we'll be right back.
This is Keith Richards, a.k.a. Just Saying. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine. But it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
Before we resume our conversation with Paul, I would like to play for you one of his songs, and he'll tell us some more about his music coming up. But this is one of his songs called Eye of the Storm.
There are so many days that I look for him when I'm tossed by an angry old sea. I go to him and he calms me again, and he stills these feelings in me. No matter what happens to me in this life, I know that he is my guide. And when I'm out of control, he touches my soul, for he's the calm in the eye of the storm. They say there's a place where it's peaceful and still, where my soul is longing to go. In the midst of the strife, there is eternal life, where it's tranquil forever, I know. And now I'm safe in the eye of the storm, where his love has provided a way. And though I'm caught by the wind, he can still me again, for he's the calm in the eye of the storm. Yes, he's the calm in the eye of the storm.
So we went from Club Med to boot camp.
Right.
I like that. So you're not supposed to just lie in bed and veg out. They really want you to start working now.
Yeah, they pretty much do. And they want you to start using a wheelchair and a walker.
Right. Well, for all manner of recovery now, they've learned that early ambulation is good for you. In other words, being a couch potato is not good for you, and it's better for your lungs, it's better for your muscles if you start moving around at your capacity as early as possible. Right, and for a stroke, all of the things that have been injured need to be exercised and retrained.
Yeah, and you know, I'd forgotten one thing. When I was doing the week of Club Med in the other hospital, they had to watch me for 2 days pretty carefully,
right,
48 hours, because of a clot buster drug thinned my blood so much. They were checking me for bleed outs in you know, any place in my body. But after that, about 3 days later, they had me start to sit up more and more, and that was my only exercise per se. So I was sitting up for as long as I could, and it was working the muscles, you know, that you use to sit up, you know, and the chest muscles. So
right.
Yeah, they got me pretty much, but it was entirely different at at the rehab.
Right.
I mean, it was like exercises and try to catch this ball. And, of course, I looked like one of Jerry Lewis's, you know, children, you know what I'm saying? I was definitely in the I can't believe this happened to me kind of mode.
So tell us about life before the stroke.
Life before the stroke.
Yeah, what kinds of activity did you like to do? What did you do for a living?
I was a programmer analyst, a business software person. I wrote music, and I played a guitar, and I played the music and played my songs in public in coffee houses and churches and
mm-hmm.
other places, but it was a very active lifestyle. I had just probably the year before I had retired to write, and I was collecting my songs and poems for my first book, and then the stroke recovery book, when I got home from the hospital, became my second book.
Here's a brief excerpt from Paul's first book, The Dreamer and the Hummingbird, which was recorded before his stroke.
The Dreamer and the Hummingbird. One day, a hummingbird flew in through my open window, and seeing me asleep on the sofa, she landed on my chest. As I was dreaming, she very delicately sipped the nectar from my heart. Knowing that the heart was the doorway to my soul, she drank what beauty she found there. I was in a deep sleep and didn't even know I had something she wanted. She had a healing touch. It was like I had some illness I was unaware of, and she cured me. She left me feeling light, like she was. I almost thought I could fly. I had been alone so long that I hurt inside. She looked into my soul and touched me. When I awakened, the hummingbird had flown away. She became my friend. I wanted to reach out and touch her, but I could not. She was delicate. Her wings beat fast. She drank from my heart's nectar, and I drank from hers. Each time she left through the open window, I didn't know if she would return. I wanted her to. The dreamer loved the hummingbird's visits. Now, every night, when sleep would come, the dreamer had a reason to dream.
I used to walk each day. I'd walk down the hill and cross the, you know, into the park and come back again. So I had a pretty good exercise regimen.
Mm-hmm. Great. So sort of a basic office worker sort of lifestyle, but with a nice walking component into
it. Exactly.
Right. And then once you had the stroke, when you were still in the hospital, what capabilities did you still have, or what had gone away?
Well, as soon as I got to the rehab hospital, they were very inquisitive about my lifestyle, and I said that I lived alone, and I lived in a downstairs apartment, and it caused them to work me a little harder because I lived alone and because I had steps to deal with. It was a pretty active lifestyle, and they got me, so they taught me to walk and walk upstairs and negotiate stairs and do all the things that a person that just had a stroke would say, well, oh my God, I got to do that, you know.
Right.
It's just, right. You know, it's just whatever I did was at the rehab unit, they wanted me to do to prepare me for going home.
Right.
And in 3 weeks' time, they did a pretty good job of getting me ready to do it.
So all your limbs were moving, even after the stroke. You were obviously weakened from being in the bed for several weeks. But did you have things that just didn't work that you had to completely retrain, or was it they were working but they needed to work better?
Well, it was, my view was at the time, nothing was working on the left side.
Uh-huh.
So I was amazed when I got anything back. So, but mm-hmm. then I began to realize that it was important for me to visualize me getting as much back as I could possibly get back. When I first went in the hospital, I couldn't even move my hand.
Hmm.
And then the nurse gave me a washcloth that she had taped into a kind of a round tubular arrangement, and I couldn't even imagine squeezing it, you know, like she wanted me to.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is that over time and over that month I was in the hospital, some did come back, but it was a function of time.
Right.
In the first 3 to 6 months, you get a lot back in that time. And the more you work, the more you exercise, the more you get back. You know, and the smart money says, the neurologist folks say that after a stroke, even as much as 5 years later, you get that function, neuromuscular functionality back and get that return.
Mm-hmm.
If you work at a good program of physical therapy. So
right.
When I got home, I didn't have medical insurance, so, you know, to get somebody to come here and help me. So I just started to do everything that they told me to do in the hospital, and I augmented that and did even harder things. So I started to lift my 10-pound hand weights and do my floor exercises, and I purchased an exercise bike, a proform mm-hmm. bike that I could set at various levels, and I started with level 3 and I worked up to 30 minutes a day, and I did my hand squeezers, you know, the little weight
right.
squeezers. I have a really difficult set of hand squeezers that I use because I'm trying to get as much manual dexterity back. Someday I would like to play the guitar again.
That would be
but
great.
Right now I'm just, you know, focused on what,
right.
you know, what I do on a daily basis. Before the stroke, I did 5 CDs.
Uh-huh.
And they became part of my first book, which is called The Dreamer and the Hummingbird, which is a collection of my song lyrics and poetry.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it was so fortunate that I did all the recording work at a local studio before I had the stroke, because it also affected my voice and my guitar before I could just, you know, rip off this stuff and do it well. But now it's going to, you know, it takes some time to get back into that, back onto that horse, so to speak.
Sure.
Let's take a little break here. When we come back from the break, we will have the first winner of our Food Matters TV viewing. And then we'll be back to talk some more with Paul about his experience recovering from stroke. This is Joyce Graff, and you're listening to The Powerful Patient.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back. This is Joyce Graff, and you're listening to The Powerful Patient. We're delighted to announce the first winners of our Food Matters TV contest. Vincent and Tracy will receive the first free ticket to a viewing of Food Matters, an 80-minute film about how to select the most beneficial foods available to us on the market today. And you could be our next winner. Please send your questions to questions@powerfulpatient.org. If you don't have a question, just send us an email. And from the emails that we receive each week, we will be selecting one winner of a free viewing of Food Matters. It's a great film, and I highly recommend it. Let's go back now and talk some more with Paul Seibert about his book, I Know How Hard You Work.
After you had the stroke, then what that brought you to was you were in the bed. The left side of your body wasn't working. So even though you could think, move that left foot, the left foot just didn't respond?
It didn't respond hardly at all.
But a tiny bit, though.
A tiny bit. And the doctor, the neurologist, would come in and he would say, squeeze my finger. Well,
right.
You know, to some extent, I could squeeze his finger. Not right away, but when he started to come in, like about 4 or 5 days later, I could squeeze it a little bit. And then, of course, they would push me. I would say, well, can you squeeze it more? You know, so I would do everything I could. So I got used to squeezing his finger as hard as I could, using my feet or legs as much as I could to propel myself in the wheelchair.
Yeah.
I didn't use a wheelchair for a week, but and they wouldn't let me stand up on my own. They wanted me to call for assistance each time I got out of bed or, you know, put my clothes on or whatever. So I was starting again. It was kind of like, movement-wise, it was like being a baby again. And I don't recall, of course, how that went, but it's too easy to fall and lose my balance. So
right.
I was beginning again on the left side of my body. So, and they worked me. They worked me pretty hard.
Yeah, and we should tell everybody that
every chance they got.
If you're in a situation like this, it's extremely important to do things the doctor's way, even though it sometimes is very frustrating.
And, very much so.
And probably felt like, oh, I don't really need that nurse to come in and walk me to the bathroom or whatever. But pay attention to that, because they're telling you that for a very good reason. And you mentioned, for example, you were on blood thinners. Well, if you fall when you have a blood thinner, any fall, it becomes a major event. Even if you, like, bump your shin on a chair, it becomes a major event because you're going to bleed very easily. So they're telling you this for a very good reason, and you need to behave yourself and actually follow instructions. So you're in this very anxious time and obviously feeling badly about the problems that you're facing. So tell us a little bit more about your emotional state at this point.
I think the first thing that hit me was anxiety, that this terrible thing had happened. I mean, I was hopeful. So that's one thing, but then I realized something was dreadfully wrong. So it's kind of hard to describe. I suppose I was depressed because because this thing had happened to me, but it dawned on me that I had to work and not so much fight, but I had to work my way back into physical movement and do what I was told by the physical therapist. So I pretty much, like I mentioned before, they gave me that initial blood thinner, but they didn't give me any more blood thinners other than aspirin. Emotionally, I was anxious, and I was... I just knew I had to get busy and do what I was told to get the functionality back as quickly as I could. So I worked hard, and I even added exercises other than what they told me. And they, of course, they liked that, you know.
Right. But you cleared with them that it was okay to add those things, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Of course, that's important to do. But certainly to work at least as hard as they say is a great thing, as long as they're in agreement.
Yeah, they love patients.
Yeah, if they ask you to do 100% and you do 50%, then obviously you're not going to make very good progress. If they ask you to do 100% and you do 110%, then you're going to do very well.
Yeah, you're only helping one person. That'd be you, you know?
Yeah, right. So, and your situation was that you didn't have the long-term insurance to go into a rehab facility. You needed to go home, and you were going to be living alone in a lower-level apartment. Did I understand that correctly? So you had a flight of stairs to go down just to get home.
Right.
So they had you on a stair climber or something to get you ready for the experience of going home?
Well, they had me, they let me climb the real little wooden steps that were like three steps, and you go up one side and down the other, and then I figured, well, this is easy enough, and then they said, well, let's try something different, which means they're getting ready to do something probably bad to you, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they took me out in the hall, and they said, well, let's go over here to the stairwell, and my heart dropped, and I thought, oh, my gosh. So we went into the stairwell. Instead of wooden steps, they were like concrete steps and steel concrete steps. And these steps led straight up to the roof, you know?
Yeah.
We're not only going to teach me to do the steps, but they're going to, I don't know, maybe they're going to try to get me over my fear of heights. You know, I wasn't sure, but... They were somewhat masochistic, but I had to pretty much go along because they weren't any worse than me. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just that the patient was me, and that was the bad part.
I can imagine looking up. It felt like a mountain to climb.
Yes, definitely a mountain. I was okay till I saw the concrete steps, and I said, "Now, Bill, don't tell me we're going to go up on the roof. I'm not going to get over my fear of heights. You know, I just want you to know, you could teach my muscles to work and my body to climb and to get over this, but I'm not going to do heights if I have a choice, you know?
Was there a time that you felt like giving up?
Not technically. I suppose there should have been, but I always thought that I was going to get better, and I always felt that whatever they taught me would be something I needed to learn, And then I always felt that, you know, somehow I felt like I was a good healer. And I was probably, if truth be told, I was going to be harder on myself than they ever were on me. So I knew I was going to get better.
Right.
I could have been in complete denial at the time, but it worked for me anyway.
You mentioned earlier that you had made some CDs before your stroke.
Right.
How was it that you made the CDs? What was the motivation for doing that?
Well, I'd been writing songs and poetry for probably about 30 years, and that was my first step in publishing my work, was to do these five CDs. And I did five CDs at the local recording studio.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of, I was sort of glad that I got all that out of the way before the stroke, because, you know, during the mixing and the recording of the five CDs, three of them were music, and I played my guitar and I sang. And the playing of the guitar and the singing was affected by the stroke, so it's a good thing we, you know, got that out of the way.
I was struck when I was listening to your songs how much they seem to talk about the very kind of recovery that you wound up going through. Tell me about Spread My Wings. You talk about the pain has lasted so long, and I'm discouraged, I've been down for a long time.
Yeah, that's a song about, that was a song I had written about getting over a love relationship.
Uh-huh.
So that, it was just my way of, I remember when I started to feel, and this is years ago, but when I felt like I was getting better from that, the grief of that love relationship ending, I remember that Saturday morning I picked up my guitar and I began to play a tune, and it was about getting over that grief.
Right, but getting over that kind of discouragement is similar to when you're healing also from physical pain.
Yeah, very definitely. The sad part of it is, Joyce, there's very little difference between all forms of grief processing and just plain going from denial of the grief to ultimately acceptance of the grief and all those steps in between. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah, essentially you're grieving the things that don't work anymore.
Exactly. And it's I'm still looking at my guitar. It's in my case, and I know that someday, or at least I think that someday, I'll play it again. But I still try to do things that are ridiculously hard for me. But I pray and I ask my higher self and I call them my intuition angels, to help me decide when I'm biting off more than I can chew for right now. But it's a process of me trying to do very hard things and then looking back and say, well, I did that, now let's see, what's next?
Okay.
So that's my way of climbing the mountain one hill at a time.
Right.
Let's listen now to Paul's song, Spread My Wings.
One more day, alone without you. One more day, the sun goes down. One more time, I'm feeling lonely. One more time, it all goes round. One more time, I cried again over some silly memory from the past. One more reason now to miss you and loving you just seems to last. I want to walk away say goodbye now. This pain has lasted much too long. I want to break the chain of memories that haunt me and leave them back there where they belong. So discouraged with the bottom, I'm tired of being this far down this long. I want to sing something besides the blues. I want to sing a different song. I want to spread my wings and fly now, like an eagle reaching for the sky. This pain has weighed down too many yesterdays. I want to spread my wings and fly. I want to spread my wings and fly now, like an eagle reaching for the sky. This pain has weighed down too many yesterdays. I want to spread my wings and fly. I want to spread my wings and fly. I want to spread my wings and fly.
Someone once said to me one time, he said that if you grieve, it's just an indication that you have loved someone. The bottom line is, when you love, someday you need to grieve. And it may not be right away. It may not be for all the same reasons. And it sounds horrible. But it many times is true, whether it's in death or divorce or someone moving or whatever. And when your body works, you take it for granted, like you do a love, that it'll always be there. Mm-hmm. But when the left side of my body stopped working after the stroke, I had to get it working again, and I had to do it through hard work. And sometimes I would experience that same grief of the body not working when I'd be doing the exercises, and I would say, oh my gosh, these are so hard, this is so hard to do this, and it's so aggravating and irritating for me that this portion of my body, the left leg and the left arm, doesn't work as good as it used to. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly working considerably better than it did right after the stroke.
Right.
And once again, thank God for that drug that they administered as soon as I got to the emergency room.
The clotbuster drug.
Yeah, the clotbuster drug.
Right. Absolutely. Did you ever feel like you wanted to give up?
I'd say no, because I thought I was going to get better. But I thought at the time, just a few days into this craziness after the stroke, I thought that the healing would be much quicker. Now, it's been 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So in my dreams at night, I go to a place where I can run and jump and, do all the things that people go do in their dreams. But when I wake up and my feet at the floor, I come back to the world where I have to work very hard day by day. So, no, I don't want to give up, but there are times when I wish it would heal faster.
Yes.
But the bottom line, if as I look at it, I'm doing marvelously. But I have to take, I have to take my pulse of what I'm doing right and how I'm getting better, I have to look at it in a different way than I used to. As I compare myself now, I have to compare me to me now, not mm-hmm. me to me before.
Right. Do you keep a journal or anything so that you can track your progress?
Well, not in so many ways, but I have a whole bunch of notebooks that I scribble in. So I guess you'd say, yes, I do. But I do it in different, probably, ways than the average person. I also include everything that happens during that day. You know, what I watch on television, what songs impressed me in that movie that I saw, and what things I have to do tomorrow, and who I have to call, and you know, it's more of an ongoing. I do the same thing now that I used to do in industry. I used to have to keep a kind of a journal of the things I worked on for that company each day, so that mm-hmm. at the end of the week when I did my progress report, I had something to pull from, you know.
Right.
Because
right.
if you don't, in the mind is a wonderful thing, but it's going to forget things like that.
Well, we forget things, but also I think, especially when you're going through a slow process like this, you don't realize how far you have come unless you can look back a week and say, oh yeah, a week ago I couldn't button my shirt.
Exactly. And I think the book, I Know How Hard You Work book, the book I wrote was kind of like a journal for that first 6 months to a year.
Mm-hmm.
But that first year was the book, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you think your perspective on the world has shifted at all since the stroke?
I think so. I think it's gotten smaller. Used to be the world was big. I mean, big. Everybody spoke a different language, and there was a kind of a we and they thing. But the bottom line is, people in every walk of life may have difficulties and strokes, and they may have to get over those things. And though we may speak a different language, we're all in the same boat in our individual lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's gotten a whole lot smaller.
So when you see someone in a wheelchair, what kinds of thoughts go through your mind?
Well, now I see them as people like me that are overcoming something. And although I don't know exactly what they go through each day, I see them, and it sounds kind of corny, but I see them as my people. I mean, people mm-hmm. that are going day by day, doing one thing at a time, and they get upset maybe with, the people that are able-bodied.
Yeah.
You know, they're parking their spaces and when they can't reach certain things and when they can't do certain things, I don't know how they feel, but I can kind of assume that how they feel is similar to the way I feel, you know?
Right, right.
And it comes back to every one of us. It has to live our lives, and in the living of our lives, we realize that the enemy is inside each one of us, and you know, we are the enemy, and we realize that we have to fight our own personal discouragement. So if it's an uphill battle that day, it may not be tomorrow, you know?
That's right. So what are the main messages to the reader in your book? It sounds like hope is an important one.
Very, very important. I say don't ever give up. God helps us every day to do all we have to do, and our exercises, our physical therapy is incredibly important. And the other thing is, it's important for me to keep an image of the well self of me in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I want to see myself walking or running, someday I'm going to do that. If I keep that image of me playing the guitar, someday I may well do that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So those three things are important. And at the end of the book, I list all the things I learned, the lessons that came over time as I wrote the book.
Could you share one or two of those with us?
Well, one of them, I think you pinned it down. Hope is the life, literally the life breath of the human spirit. And it's the hope is imperative for me each day. I think another one is the fact that after the stroke, I realized that I have no time left for frivolities, but only those things are very important for me to do. And the important things each day. So if anything, you know, I spent less time on unimportant things. I think another thing, you know, realizing that I was going to overcome all that I needed to overcome, and that I needed to realize that, like the butterfly in the cocoon, I was going to be transformed by this whole thing. I was going to become a different creature, similar to the caterpillar. I was going to crawl out of my cocoon and fly someday. And the flying may be different than the butterfly, but still, I was being transformed, and a lot of very positive things needed to be done in my mind prior to actually doing them. And then sometimes I just have to push the envelope and go ahead and do some things that don't really seem like what the safe rules might say to do, you know. Mm-hmm. But I know when to quit, and I know when to not push it any harder. But still and all, I need the courage to do each day, even hard things.
Right, so courage and persistence are very essential ingredients here.
Right, exactly.
And a sense of humor, I assume.
You know, you mentioned what I sometimes forget, and yeah, the humor, you have two choices. You emotions are going to come, and I can cry about it or I can laugh about it, and I probably will do both, but still, it's important for me to appreciate the humor in it all.
Right.
And it's not so much, it's not funny that I had a stroke, but some of the crap that happens on a daily basis is funny, you know?
Right.
And I have to look at it as funny, you know, when I do clumsy things, as opposed to being upset with myself, because the main issue is to learn to love myself more in this whole thing and accept who
I
am.
I like your image of holding on to the vision of yourself as a well person and keeping that while not, you're not frozen by that. It's like if you don't become that guitar player again, it's not the end of the world. But it is something to strive for.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I don't think about it all the time. I mean, I have a book signing for one of my books in January, and I could say, well, maybe I never will play the guitar again.
Right.
But I have a book signing in January. You know, so
that you never had before.
That's exactly right. And
so you've evolved into someone a little different. We all grow and change, and we can do some new things that we couldn't do before, and we can not do some things that we used to do. And that's part of aging and evolving in life in general, whether or not you've had an illness.
Very true. Many times, you know, I go in the direction of my songs, and sometimes I go in the direction of my books, and sometimes I just meditate, and I go in the direction of positive thinking. Sometimes I have to climb the stairs, you know, and sometimes,
yes.
Well, you know, I go out for dinner, and I hobble into a restaurant, and I'm looking, and the other people aren't walking with a cane.
Right. But some people can't walk with a cane.
Yeah, some people can't even be there. But, you know, because they're in a bed someplace. But the bottom line, I have something really neat to share with you. This week, it was Wednesday, I said, okay, now I've been using a cane for 3 years. And I said, maybe not outside when I go outside the house. But when I'm around the house, I'll put my cane away and I'll just walk without my cane. So I started doing that Wednesday. So this is something brand new. This is Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and today's Sunday. So there's 5 days we've been walking without the cane around the house. Now, to me, that's a big deal.
Yes.
Now, outside, since I could follow my butt, it's not as good a landing outside as inside. But, and there's ice out, you know, for probably another year outside or a while, until I get more sure-footed, you know, I may use it outside. But I don't know. I don't know how good I'm going to get, and I think that's a realization that I am left with daily when I want to, when I maybe I'm tempted to get discouraged, I have to say, yeah, but I don't know how good I'm going to get.
That's right.
The glass,
you're not finished improving yet.
Yeah, I'm getting better every day, and the glass is more than half full, so I can't say it's half empty.
Very good. Well, thank you very, very much. I really appreciate your being with us today. And we'll remind everybody to look at paulseibert.com. The information and the links will be in the handout that goes with this show.
Sure.
So go to powerfulpatient.org and look for the handout there.
Okay.
And we'll look for your book as well. And wish
Make
you
sure
all
you
the very best.
Spell the name out, paulsybert.com.
Okay. Right.
And they can listen. I'll sing them a song and read them a poem.
Very good.
Thank you very much, Paul, for sharing your messages of hope and persistence and constant improvement. The improvement can go on for as much as 5 years. So don't give up. It's a long path, but it frequently is a very fruitful path and well worth the effort. We're going to be making some important changes at powerfulpatient.org in the next several weeks. For the new year, we're going to have a slightly new look. So please keep in touch with us at powerfulpatient.org. And next week, we're going to talk with Sean Clark, who is a professor who focuses on improving the quality of patient care, particularly for cardiac patients, but in general for patients in hospitals. So be with us next week and talk with Dr. Clark. And meanwhile, this is Joyce Graff, hoping that you will be well and be a powerful patient.